It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Late last year, Microsoft finalized a deal with the town of Mount Pleasant to develop about 1,000 acres of land that had been part of the Wisconsin Foxconn project. Among Microsoft's building plans, a data center. That is just one among many projects around the country to build new data centers and server farms, in part to keep up with the demands of artificial intelligence and cryptocurrency. But here's the thing. These places use a lot of electricity, and there's worry that power grids may not be able to keep up. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about data centers, what they are, how they work, how much power they need? Do you think a lot about the electrical power grid in your area? Do you have questions or ideas on how to improve it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Evan Halper is a business reporter for The Washington Post covering the energy transition. Evan, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And Lena Rold is associate professor and Granger Institute fellow at the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Lena, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Evan, first of all, tell us about these data centers and similar projects, what they are and why there's such a booming market for them right now.
So basically, data centers have been around for decades. And, you know, they're places where there's just lots of computers. They look like big warehouses. They may not look like much if you pass one on a highway, but they're just the place where there's all kinds of computer storage. And what they do is they do all these sophisticated operations. So if you're using Netflix or you're going on the cloud or a lot of the things we're doing now on our computers, the function is routing through a data center. But a big part of what they're doing also now and why they're needing more and more energy is they're kind of the foundation of artificial intelligence. It takes a huge amount of computing power to do all the stuff that we're reading about and hearing about with AI. And this AI industry is just ramping up much more quickly than even the AI experts had anticipated a year or two ago. And the amount of power that they need to do what they want to do in this industry is just immense.
And Evan, in your reporting, you point out that, experts project how much electricity we expect to use from year to year. And in this new landscape, in part because of these data centers and part of some other clean energy transition stuff, we are going way, way over those expectations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was interesting at the start of the show, you mentioned, do your readers think about the electricity grid much? I think most of us haven't been thinking about it because we've always just taken for granted that in this country, there'll be power, there'll be electricity, and it'll be relatively cheap. And we're reaching this inflection point where the power grid we have just can't keep up with the demand. And so there's a lot of questions right now about, okay, what kind of power are we going to bring on? How much are we going to invest in fixing the infrastructure? Do these data centers, because they're taking so much power, in some cases a data center will go up and it'll use more power than, you know, an entire small city. Should they be building their own power plants and be off the grid? A lot of tough questions.
Lena, okay, you are an expert on our electrical grid. That's why we bring you on the show from time to time. As you look at this growth in data centers, server farms, and more, what are your hopes and fears for our power grid?
Yeah, so I think that is a really interesting question. Of course, with the data centers, they are growing very, very rapidly, as Evan was explaining. It's in some ways a bit of a surprise to people, I think, because we have for a very long time been able to just keep doing more computing. We've been able to, use the internet more, do more and more computing without actually seeing a very rapid increase in the amount of power that goes into data centers. And this is partially because there's been an incredible increase in the efficiency of the data centers themselves, of the hardware that is in there. But now we are kind of coming to a point where many of the sort of easier efficiency gains have been exhausted. And so as we are moving forward, the increased need for computing for new uses such as AI is increasingly translating directly into more electricity use. And that is challenging because it's also coming at this time when we want electricity for a whole lot of other uses. We want electrification of transportation, more electric vehicles. We want to electrify our heating systems. Probably many of us have installed heat pumps at home. There are other things that are happening, like incentives for green hydrogen production. And all of these our new demands on the electric grid to provide electricity where and when we need it. And data centers are a really, really large addition to the grid that is then competing along with all these other uses for electricity. And so when I'm looking at it, there's a lot of challenges we have to solve in order to make all of this work out and make sure that we are able to have the electricity we need for everyone who need it.
Lena, one concern I've seen in Evan's reporting and elsewhere is that for climate change reasons, one of our big goals is to reduce our reliance on coal power plants. Well, these new demands on the grid are maybe leading coal power plants to stay open past when people were hoping to retire them. Is that something you're seeing around the country?
Yes, so we can see, I mean, for example, here in Wisconsin, we have news of our coal power plants retiring. Some of them are fuel switching to natural gas, but much of that capacity that we've had in terms of coal power generation is just being retired and replaced with renewable energy. And that is welcome because it lowers emissions of carbon dioxide and also other more local pollutants. But then, of course, we need to make sure that we are able to replace that power and, in many cases, build it out. And so already before we look at increased data center load, there has been concerns of reliability of the grid due to this maybe too rapid switch off of conventional power plants. And then when you're adding on these large increases in electricity demand, that can make it harder to make that switch for sure. And so I think that is definitely a concern that, you know, we need to make sure hopefully this that the increased need for computing power is not going to derail the energy transition and our weaning off of fossil fuels.
We're talking about our electrical power grid, new demands from high technology, artificial intelligence processes and cryptocurrency being run at a massively growing data center industry around the country. Lena Rold is with us from the UW-Madison College of Engineering, Evan Halper with the Washington Post, and you could join in with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. Evan, you report there's a big change for some economic development officials around the country where they used to actively recruit, try to lure any business, including these data centers. Some of them are starting to have second thoughts. What are you seeing around the country?
Yeah, this is really pronounced in Georgia. You know, that's a place where they've been trying to attract all kinds of business, and they're really big on tax incentives. And the thinking there was, you know, they just after just a really long process and going over budget and you know, years behind schedule, they got this nuclear reactor built. And the thinking was, okay, we have all this power now, we can afford to bring all these manufacturers and these data centers in. They offered these tax incentives. And now Georgia is quickly running out of power. I mean, they're, you know, I talked to the head of the state commission that regulates the power companies there. And he said, you know, I just don't even see how we got this so wrong. And we got our projections wrong. And so the state is, they're moving toward ending their subsidies, the tax subsidies for the data centers, because they just have too many of them. And they're really worried about their grid right now. You know, this is also happening in other places where they really incentivized data centers to come in and just assume there'd be enough power, but they're taking up so much power that the power companies are now saying, you know, we're not going to be able to give you, data center company, the amount of power we thought we would as quickly, or the amount of power you expected as quickly. And now we need to do a study, and it may take years to get the power you thought you were going to get, you know, next year. And so some of these data center developers are just picking up and they're moving to other places. You know, they used to look to locate where they were near all the major internet infrastructure because they wanted that speed and they wanted to get the data to users quick. Now they're just looking, I mean, their priority when data centers are locating is like, does a place have the power that we need? And more places just don't, or they're not going to have it quickly enough.
Lena, one possible solution you pointed to, you sent us a note about this. You know, we've heard the idea of utility companies for home users saying, hey, if you use electricity, do your dishes or whatever in the middle of the night at off-peak hours, well, maybe it'll be cheaper then. Is there something in the timing of how these centers that could be used to help match demand to supply?
Yes. So you can consider that there are So when we think about data centers, many of the computing jobs that are running are really important to do right away. Mm-hmm. If you do, for example, a Google search or you want to look at your email, you don't want to wait a very long time to get access to the information that you are seeking. However, there are other types of computing jobs, for example, AI and the training of machine learning models that is sort of the backbone of AI. Those can oftentimes wait a little bit. It might not be important to do it right now. Maybe this is something that could run overnight or could be delayed maybe even a day or two and then be taken into use a little bit, just a little bit later. And if you were able to shift in time when you actually do this kind of computing, then you could be able to shape the amount of power consumption that is happening and try to match that better with the availability of power. And that could be availability of power from the grid overall, but it could also be availability of renewable energy, for example, wind and solar power. And so you could try and leverage this kind of flexibility in when you do computing in order to obtain cleaner and cheaper electricity for the computing. And then because many of these companies that have large data centers also have data centers in different locations, in many cases, they keep the data that they need to do computations at multiple locations for redundancy and security reasons. And so there might also be a possibility that you can not only shift in time when you do computing, but you could also shift it in space. So that is an opportunity to actually help the grid run better by maybe not using electricity when it is not available. So there's certainly things computing companies could do on that end.
We're talking about our electrical system in Wisconsin and around the country as demand is going up, exceeding expectations for demand in part because of an explosion of computer data centers. Our guests are Evan Halper, business reporter for The Washington Post, covering the energy transition, and Lena Rold, associate professor of engineering at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what you're hearing? Do you work in energy or data or clean technology fields? What are you seeing on this issue from your perspective? If you live in the Mount Pleasant area, how do you feel about the sale of some of the former Foxconn land to Microsoft for data center development? Should we charge more to companies that use electricity for these data centers? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Lena Rold from the UW-Madison College of Engineering and Evan Halper, business reporter at The Washington Post, talking about the energy transition and our electrical power grids and what needs to be done for them to keep up with a steadily growing demand for electricity from things like data centers and clean technology outfits. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts or questions, that's 800-642-1234. Lena, one possible obvious solution would be, I guess, build more power plants of various types and more transmission lines to get the power to where it's needed for these places. Is that something we're prepared to do, that we're able to do, to keep up with this rising demand?
Yes. So how to get access to power? Sure. Then you need both the power plants and you need the transmission lines, as you mentioned. And there are challenges with that. I mean, particularly when we're thinking about build out of renewable energy, there are things that are hampering that development, both in terms of supply chain issues, but also just finding the land and the communities that are willing to host the renewable energy plants. And so you can imagine that if a big company comes and says, oh, we want to build a lot of wind turbines here to power a data center, a community might look at that differently than if they were thinking that these, for example, a new wind turbine is going to power their own homes. And so I think there are questions around how we can keep up, both in terms of finding the available land and also building the necessary transmission infrastructure in order to power those new data centers and other sources of electricity or other demands, new demands for electricity. And so it's kind of challenging to build those new transmission lines, to find, even just to find out if the grid has sufficient capacity to support a new data center or other big load, or even a whole group of loads of new generators can be challenging. And then there are also challenges that arise if utility decides that you actually need more lines, transmission lines, to, for example, connect a new data center, then it's typically the data center or a new generator that has to pay for that upgrade. And so that can make it very costly. So there are many questions around who are actually going to bear the cost of building out that additional infrastructure, whether it's the new power lines or the power plants, and also who would, what are the communities and the land that is going to be used in order to build this.
Let's bring in a caller. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So as far as data centers are concerned, is there any legislation or incentives that are kind of built into any of these deals that require certain efficiencies? Are there any models that we should be looking at?
Interesting. Evan, in your reporting, have you encountered that kind of thing, saying, yeah, build your server farm, use the electricity, but there's some strings attached?
You know, there are definitely lawmakers that are looking into it, but these proposals haven't been getting a lot of traction so far. That could change as the power crunch really, really becomes more and more serious. But at the moment, several states actually have rules that prohibit utilities from discriminating against any user. I mean, this came into play with crypto mining operations, which just use a tremendous amount of energy. And, in some states, they have regulations that say the utility, you know, cannot discriminate against a crypto mining operation, has to give them the power. In a lot of states, they've been, as we were talking about before, they've been giving incentives because they want to bring the tax revenue in from the data centers and weren't really thinking about this power crunch. And they've just been taken by surprise by just how much power and how much the need is ramped up so quickly. So now you're starting to see there's a proposal in the U.S. Senate. I'm sure you're going to start to see proposals. There was a proposal in Virginia. I'm sure that you're going to start to see proposals in a lot of states. We'll see if they move forward. But those proposals would do what your caller is suggesting, you know, make these centers think about operating more efficiently, require some studies to figure out does what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And right now there's just not a lot of regulation that would require a data center to operate more efficiently in one place over another.
Chris, thanks for the call. Evan, one thing I wanted to ask about, you write that some companies building these places are starting to take the grid into their own hands, trying to supply their own sources of power. What are some examples you've seen?
Yeah, so we talked to a developer who thought they were going to get power from the grid in outside of Portland, Oregon. And then they were told, no, we need to do what's called a line and load study. And for data center developers, and a lot of them are hearing this like a lot lately, that's basically the utility telling them, you know, we thought maybe we could serve you, but now we're starting to worry that too many connections are trying to come on, and we need to just take a pause and see who we can serve. And so in this case, they went and used natural gas to make these hydrogen cells, which is kind of a complicated technology and it's very expensive. But they said for their next project, they were going to go out to South Texas and dig deep to do a geothermal project where you kind of like go deep into the Earth's core and get and use the heat from that to generate like a tremendous amount of energy. But it's an expensive and, you know, relatively nascent technology. You're hearing a lot of data center developers talk about trying to build small nuclear plants. Having covered the nuclear industry, I can tell you the timeline they're trying to move on and the timeline that regulators are moving on. It's hard to imagine that, you know, these small nuclear plants, which don't even exist yet, would be up and running in the time that they need all this power. But they're looking at every available option and every way to build their own small power plants, so they can get the power they need on the, you know, the very compressed timeline that they're looking for it.
Time for one more caller. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm wondering also about the impact that electric cars are going to have on the grid. It seems like everybody's turning to electricity as their redeemer, but it also means that that's going to add weight to the overall demand for electricity.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Lena, the electric cars and also electric heat pumps, maybe replacing natural gas furnaces. How big an impact will that have on demand for electricity?
Yeah, so clearly that is also going to be something that will increase the electricity demand and in some cases kind of substantially. The impact on the grid is quite different than what it is in terms of the data centers, because you can imagine that the cars are many, but rather small, and so they are kind of spread throughout the grid, and the heat pumps as well, right? And then, of course, the cars also move around, and so they can charge at different times and different locations. And so there is definitely kind of both questions around how we are going to support that overall increase in electricity demand, but also just how we are going to make sure that the electricity is available kind of at the household level at all times. Because if you add electric vehicles at every house and heat pumps at every house, it's not only the big grid, the one that is supporting the data centers, you know, the large transmission lines that go across the state and between states and across the country. Those are the ones that support large loads like the data centers, but small loads like electric vehicles and heat pumps, they have to be supported by the small electric lines that are going to our own homes. And so that kind of causes also issues at that level, kind of the more local level. And so, yeah, there's definitely questions around both overall increases in electricity demand, but also kind of just in the grid infrastructure. Data centers and electric vehicles and heat pumps are kind of different beasts.
Rick, thanks for that call. And we'll leave it there. Lena, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Evan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking to Evan Halper, business reporter for The Washington Post, covering the energy transition, and Lena Ruhl, associate professor and Granger Institute fellow at the UW-Madison College of Engineering. We talked to them about the limitations of our existing power grid that are being further tested by increased demand from data centers, Bitcoin miners, and clean technology projects. If this is a concern in your community or you work in the industries we're talking about, still love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday wasn't just an unexpectedly snowy spring day for a lot of the state. It was also Election Day and Wisconsin's chance to weigh in on presidential nominations. The candidates already decided in the presidential race, but there were significant votes for something other than Biden and Trump. There were a couple of election-related constitutional amendments on the ballot, as well as a number of local races for mayor, school, referenda, other local offices. We're going to focus on the ballot initiatives and the presidential race, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote in yesterday's primary? What motivated you to head to the polls or vote in advance? Was there a single issue that got you to cast your ballot for a local or presidential candidate? Did you make a protest vote of some sort in either of the presidential primaries? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Before we tackle the presidential race, let's talk about these two successful ballot measures, both related to election management. Question one about keeping private donations and grants from being used to run elections in the state. Question two says only election officials could carry out tasks needed to run an election. These were all aftermaths, I think, of the 2020 COVID year of elections. Talk us through why these ended up getting into the state constitution.
Well, I mean, they both came in with about a 10-point spread. So that's, you know, it wasn't that close on either of the measures. But the one with regard to public funding means that municipalities cannot receive any grants or outside support. All the money has to come either from localities, the state, or possibly the federal government. And the other one, which seems to also be potentially leaving us with some legal questions that will need to be determined, is who is a legally designated election official in all of this? So are those the same as poll workers? Are the people who work in the municipalities all considered legally designated election officials? That has to be decided.
The origins of these, as I mentioned, I think came out of 2020. Lily, election officials were worried about extra costs associated with the elections and keeping people safe during COVID. There were requests, hopes for more funding coming from the state. That didn't really happen as much as people hoped. And that's where some outside groups, including ones notably funded by Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook / Meta fame, Republicans criticized that afterward. You know, in most normal elections, unlike 2020, are these things they see having a lot of impact?
I think 2020 was definitely an exception given the COVID situation and also trying to run all of these primaries and then general election in the COVID context. I mean, you remember in March of 2020, we were, you know, just in lockdown and it was very difficult to figure out how to vote safely. So I think that these are somewhat in response to attempts to make sure that people could vote safely 4 years ago at the height of the pandemic.
All right, let's turn now, Lily, to the primary campaign for president. Now we know Donald Trump has enough delegates on his side. Joe Biden has enough delegates on his side. They are the nominees for all intents and purposes. Did Wisconsin's primary matter in some significant way?
I don't know that it mattered in terms of these two people getting the nomination of their respective parties. What I do think has to be paid attention to is both of them had a lot of folks who voted, you know, either for a Republican or for a Democrat who was not Joe Biden or Donald Trump. And since the sort of winning margin in Wisconsin in the most recent elections, not just in 2020, but in 2016 as well, were very, very small, that the fact that we had about 50,000 votes against Joe Biden in the primary, and we had over 100,000 votes against Trump in the primary yesterday.
Lily Gorin is with us, political scientist at Carroll University. We're looking at yesterday's primary election day in Wisconsin, general election in many local races as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on those two constitutional amendment ballot measures? Big deal or meh? And did you vote in the presidential primary? Did you enthusiastically vote for, say, one party's known candidate at this point? Or did you vote against one of them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lily, I want to dig more into those against votes of various sorts. So let's start on the Democratic side. We've seen in various states now people running a campaign calling for an uninstructed vote that got 8.3%, I believe, or so of the vote in the Democratic side yesterday. A lot of it is a protest over President Biden's handling of the Israel-Gaza war. How important, how significant is this uninstructed campaign?
Well, I think that the uninstructed campaign, as well as like the 1 or 2 percentage points that Dean Phillip also got, shows to Biden that, you know, there are votes out there that are probably his in Wisconsin, which he needs to carry to continue to be president, to be reelected. And that 50,000 votes is larger than how much he carried the state by in 2020. And since the uninstructed votes seem to be used as commentary and critique on his position with regard to the Gaza-Israeli situation, this is an area where there is some fracturing within the Democratic Party in terms of support for the Israeli government, the war cabinet, and Israeli military incursions into Gaza.
A huge open question here that I don't think anybody probably has the right answer to is how many of those uninstructed voters will say, okay, well, maybe the Republicans, we wouldn't count on them to do it much different on Israel and Gaza. So they would come back and vote for Joe Biden versus saying, no, we are dug in and not going to vote for Joe Biden. What are you watching for as that sorts out over the next bunch of months?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, polling that takes place in Wisconsin to see if some of those voters do, in fact, come to, you know, support Biden, according to polls, that would be instructive. But at the same time, the number that I sort of quoted with regard to Trump has more people he needs to pull in, who voted in one form or another against him.
And that takes us to the Republican side of things. Trump ending up with 79% of Republican voters. Nikki Haley, just shy of 13%. Ron, I think that was a little high. But as you said, 120,000 votes led by Nikki Haley. Ron DeSantis got some of the other candidates who had all dropped out quite a while ago, got some votes. And again, what do you watch for to see whether those someone other than Trump voters would come back and vote for Trump in November?
Well, again, if we see polling with regard to, say, undecided voters on either side, if we don't see the sort of higher numbers of support for either candidate in polling that continues to be taken in Wisconsin, then we may be able to sort of gauge what these voters, now we've got, you know, about 150,000 voters who came out in really bad weather, like really bad weather, to cast a kind of protest vote.
Now, speaking of the bad weather, I want to give a listen to a couple voices from the Trump campaign rally talking about early voting for Republicans. There's been tension within the party on whether people should vote early. Let's start with Republican Senator Ron Johnson making the case for.
Embrace voting as it is. You know, I love voting on election day, but because when I became a United States Senator, I had to vote absentee ballot. We need to embrace that, and today is the perfect example why. We can't afford to have a miserable election day on November and not have our votes already banked. So embrace early voting. We have to do that.
But former President Trump has been making the case against early voting. He goes into familiar direction as he's talking about election night 2020.
Remember 10 o'clock? Everyone's calling me. They're saying, congratulations, sir. The biggest congratulations, sir. I said, yeah, but, you know, these people are cheaters. But I don't like to accept anything yet. And then at 3:02 in the morning, a lot of dumps happened. A lot of bad things happened.
So Trump reinforcing his claims that early voting, mail-in voting is susceptible to fraud. This is something that has, I think, a lot of Republican local leaders in Wisconsin and elsewhere worried, Lily, that they're trying to send this message, as Ron Johnson was, vote early, vote by mail. I'm getting those emails from various Republican campaign lists, and Donald Trump sending a different message.
Yeah, and it is somewhat confusing to voters because you're sort of telling them to do two very different things. And for different reasons too. And again, with early voting, with absentee voting, generally speaking, there is no evidence of systematic fraud. What does in fact happen, and it's according to the laws of each state, is when the absentee ballots can actually be counted and thus integrated into the tallies.
We are talking about the results of yesterday's primary election in Wisconsin and the 2024 campaigns in the months to come. Lily Gorin is with us from Carroll University, political science professor there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about the primary results and the campaign ahead. Did you attend former President Trump's rally in Green Bay? What did you think? Did you vote yesterday or vote in advance? Did you vote against a candidate in one primary or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, looking at results from yesterday's primary in Wisconsin and where the 2024 campaigns go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, what led you to vote the way you did, or not to vote the way you didn't in the election yesterday, join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellen is with us in Cedarburg. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think you can imagine how hard it must have been for me yesterday to vote against a Democratic president who I largely support. But I'm a born and raised Chicago Irish Catholic Democrat. It was very hard to do, but I did it because we don't want our hands bloodied anymore with this horrible Israeli massacre going on in Gaza. And I was very happy to hear about the 100,000 against Trump too. That also helped.
Ellen, if I could put you on the spot, between now and November, do you think, it sounds like you voted uninstructed, would you vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump in November?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I wanted to send a message.
Ellen, thanks a lot for that call. Lily, there's one data point from Ellen there. People voting to send a message doesn't necessarily mean they would vote against Joe Biden or do not vote for Joe Biden in November.
Yeah, and again, Helen represents probably quite a few people on both sides of the aisle who are registering protests of one kind or another. There are quite a few Republicans, as I understand it, who are opposed to Donald Trump as the nominee. He's going to be the nominee, just like Joe Biden's going to be the nominee. And so voting uninstructed or for Nikki Haley in yesterday's primary makes a lot of sense because it's also not going to tip Donald Trump out of the position as the standard bearer for the Republican Party. Same thing with regard to Joe Biden and what the caller just noted she's going to do.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ellen. And mentioning Nikki Haley, she did, in fact, get 12.8% of the vote yesterday. I don't know why I doubted that. I was right the first time, wrong the second time, right the third time. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in La Crosse. Josh, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What's on your mind, Josh?
So last two presidentials, I voted Republican, but this year I'm swaying to the independent vote for Robert Kennedy. The frustrating thing is nobody's talking about Robert Kennedy out there. He's on the ballot in other states. He's going to be on the ballot in July here in Wisconsin. We're working on that. But it's just frustrating how the independent party is not put out there as much as the other two main parties. Why is that?
Josh, thanks for the call. Lily, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a simple and complicated response. Mm-hmm. But each state determines how an individual and or a party can get onto the ballot. So in order to get onto a ballot, you probably have to have a certain number of signatures, or you have to have cleared a certain level of percentage points in the previous election in order to have the party and therefore a candidate from a party on the ballot. But each state has different ballot access laws. And that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to sort of get a third or fourth party, fully integrated into the system, because you have to do it state by state.
Josh, thanks a lot for that call. And Josh identifies as someone who voted Republican in a couple of presidential races, who's leaning toward Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Democrats are worried that they might lose Democrats to somebody with the last name Kennedy. Certainly, Lily, what are you watching for to see how that shakes out? I know a lot of pollsters are trying different three or four or five candidate matchups.
Yeah, and I have to defer to the pollsters because I am not one myself, but they are trying to tease out who Kennedy potentially pulls candidates from or pulls votes from, as well as whether or not the No Labels Party is going to pull votes from either candidate. And it's very tricky to do this in terms of trying to focus on just a protest vote, say, or somebody who's really going to be committed to voting for a third party or fourth party candidate in November.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Lily Gorin is with us, professor of political science at Carroll University. We're moving forward from yesterday's primary election, looking at the campaign ahead. Lily, issues being talked about, former President Trump at the rally talked about immigration, We'll be hearing a lot about that from him and from other Republicans, I assume. Democrats are still talking a lot about abortion. A Florida ballot measure coming up is reigniting that issue. What are you watching for when it comes to what the campaigns, what the candidates want us talking and thinking about?
Well, the issues with these two particular issue areas is that the last two election cycles, the Democrats have actually had support, or, you know, they've received support through ballot initiatives or other issues where abortion was, quote, on the ballot. And at the same time, Donald Trump, since he came down the escalator in 2015, 2016, has been talking about issues around immigration, particularly at the southern border. So both of these issue areas definitely connect with base voters in each party in different ways. And so the question is also, how do they connect with swing voters? Or are they able to, you know, be able to use these kinds of issues to try to attract people to them who might otherwise be skeptical?
I want to look ahead. In August, we'll have our primaries for Congress and Senate. I think our U.S. Senate candidates seem to be pretty locked in at this point. Do you see any congressional seats being at play in Wisconsin? We've got Mike Gallagher leaving literally an open seat. He will retire from the House before that election. Thoughts that Western Wisconsin could be close, possibly a better contender for Democrats for the seat currently held by Brian Steil in southern and southeastern Wisconsin. Do you have your eye on any particular congressional races?
No, I was intrigued by Gallagher's sort of resignation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that he was really a you know, very perfect, if you want to say that, kind of candidate for the GOP in that district. And also as somebody who may have, you know, a longer political future. And so his early resignation is interesting. And I'm not necessarily sure, you know, to some degree where that leaves the party, the Republican Party in that seat. They need to, you know, find somebody else. And the Democrats should probably run somebody to see if they can pick that seat up. Because, the closeness of the divide in Congress is about two votes.
Let's go back to our callers. Fran is with us in Oostburg. Fran, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I voted for President Biden in the primary, and I will be voting for him in the general election, because for me, this whole thing is basically, I think he's done a good job, but also to save our democracy. For all of the issues that are out there, to me, it's one of the greatest ones right now.
Fran, thanks a lot for the call. And Lily, President Biden has been making that exact case that his opponent, Donald Trump, would be a threat to the future of American democracy. Do you see this as something that will appeal to more than just Fran?
I think it was a lot of what he also ran on, what Biden also ran on in 2020. I think it continues to be a topic and an issue that is important to a variety of voters. I also think that this is an interesting issue that is very attractive to Republican never Trumpers. And depending on, you know, how many of them there are, and I don't know how many there are, that a lot of the concern that these never Trump Republicans have is with regard to the threat from Trump in terms of democracy.
Time for one more quick call. Carl is with us in Pewaukee. Carl, hi.
Hi, I am a never Trumper and consider myself a Republican for quite a long time, and voted for Biden the last time. And I was really looking for somebody to step up in the Republican Party to really take the lead on it. Anyone but Trump. And this time, to be honest with you, I'm probably going to vote for Biden as a show to my party to say, do better.
Carl, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time, Lily, but you just referenced, you don't know how many never Trumpers there are. There's at least one.
Yes. And again, Carl is also sounding like he's voting for Biden in a kind of protest vote to send a message to the Republican Party.
Carl, thanks for that call. And Lily, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. We talked to her today about results from yesterday's primary election, what it all means for the 2024 campaigns and the November general election. You can follow more results online at WPR.org and keep up with the WPR news team there over the course of this election year. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, author James Patterson joins the program to share stories of his heroes. Who are his heroes? In a new book, he says they are booksellers and librarians. Join that conversation. It's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. What time is it? The answer depends on where on Earth you are in the local time zone. But what if you're not on Earth at all? As reported by the BBC, the U.S. government assigned NASA the task of figuring out a time zone and a timekeeping system for the moon. It's important to coordinate the clock with moon probes and landers. You can see where that might be tricky, the moon's orbit and rotation and whatnot. They're different than Earth's. But wait, it's even weirder. Gravity affects the flow of time. The moon has less gravity than Earth, so time elapses at a different rate. According to scientists quoted in the article, an atomic clock on Earth and one on the moon would tick at different rates. Difference of 58.7 microseconds every day. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're doing complicated space stuff, it can add up. What's the timeline on moon time? NASA is aiming for 2026 and time for people to land on the moon again, according to current plans. Take a microsecond to think about that. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. E-cigarettes and vaping have taken over as preferred alternatives to smoking among young people. But a new alternative product is rising in popularity and has some health officials concerned. Sales of oral nicotine pouches from brands like Zyn, On, and Velo have skyrocketed in the last year. The products have gone viral with influencers on social media who see them as a cleaner alternative to tobacco products. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is among those concerned about nicotine pouches being potentially dangerous for teens. Earlier this year, he called on the FDA to investigate the marketing and health concerns of products like Zyn.
It's a pouch packed with problems, high levels of nicotine. So today, I'm delivering a warning to parents because these nicotine pouches seem to lock their sights on young kids, teenagers, and even lower, and then use the social media to hook them.
Schumer's comments drew pushback from Republican lawmakers who expressed support for Zyn and consumers' ability to choose whether or not to use the product. We're learning more about how these oral nicotine pouches work, how they're marketed, what impacts they could have on our health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use these nicotine pouches yourself? Are you seeing them pop up in your community? What do you think about them? What questions do you have about them? Do you see them as a potentially better alternative to smoking or vaping? Are you worried about the potential for underage use? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Brittany Keller Hamilton is an epidemiologist and assistant professor in the Division of Medical Oncology at Ohio State University's College of Medicine. She's the lead author on a recent study published in the medical journal Addiction about the effects of oral nicotine pouches. Brittany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
For people who haven't encountered these yet, Brittany, can you talk about what these oral nicotine pouches are and how they work?
Sure. So nicotine pouches, as you mentioned, are sold under brand names like Zyn and On. They are small white pouches that contain a powder with nicotine, flavoring chemicals, shelf stabilizers. But the important difference between nicotine pouches and other oral tobacco products like dip is that nicotine pouches don't contain any tobacco leaf.
This is still a pretty new product, at least in wide use in the United States. I assume that means we don't have a lot of long-term studies on health impacts. What kind of things do we know and what kind of questions do you still have?
Sure. So for the things that we do know, you're right. We don't know a lot about them yet. There has been no long-term use study that's been conducted. The closest product to these would be snus, which is widely used in Scandinavian countries. And snus does contain tobacco leaf, but it's a less harmful form of a tobacco product. and it does carry much lower health risks than cigarette smoking.
That's one of the tricky... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, but I think to me, one of the biggest things we don't know from the youth angle, which I understand is a point of interest, is what happens after a youth gets addicted to nicotine pouches. If they continue using nicotine pouches, that's one thing. But if they end up transitioning to more harmful products like cigarettes or other forms of smokeless tobacco, then nicotine pouches really deserve a second look.
This is a conversation we've had a lot about things like vaping for young people. We've seen this long-term decline in the use of tobacco products and nicotine products among younger people. Then along comes vaping, and that initial nicotine use seems to go up. Do we have lessons from vaping that suggest what happens next if those young people go on to use that and other nicotine products in the long run?
Yes, I think we do. Vaping is definitely a cautionary tale. As you said, the prevalence of cigarette smoking and smokeless tobacco use has been declining pretty steadily among youth in the United States. But then e-cigarettes arrived and prevalence got pretty high. And then Juul arrived and they used some chemistry, which I'm happy to talk about some more. But they basically made it so that it was tolerable to inhale higher concentrations of nicotine, which is really when we started to see the prevalence of e-cigarette use start to soar among youth. My concern with nicotine pouches is that we're seeing some of the same chemical manipulations in nicotine pouches that they were kind of playing the same game that they played with e-cigarettes and that they played with earlier forms of smokeless tobacco like dip, where there are products that are kind of milder, more appealing to somebody without nicotine dependence, but then also products available that deliver a huge amount of nicotine to the user and are ultimately harder to quit. So I do think it's worth following nicotine pouches for that reason.
You also look into marketing of these kinds of products. And we know over the years, the tobacco industry has been accused of, internal documents show that they have been trying to bring in new generations of tobacco users over the decades. Do you see anything in the marketing of these pouch products that has you worried when it comes to young people?
So I think the marketing relative to what we were seeing with e-cigarettes is probably a little more cautious. Maybe a lesson was learned there. But something that's really interesting to me is that the tobacco industry kind of cornered the market for white men using smokeless tobacco, especially white rural men or white Appalachian men. And it's been noted from a few different studies now that they're trying to market nicotine pouches now more broadly to women and people of color. So trying to bring some new consumers into the oral nicotine marketplace.
We're talking to Brittany Keller-Hamilton, epidemiologist and oncology professor at The Ohio State University, looking at a rising product, oral nicotine pouches under brand names like Zyn, and how they affect our health, concerns about younger users. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this news to you? Do you have questions about what these things are and how they work? Have you used nicotine pouch products like Zyn or some of the other brand names out there? Have you seen young people in your community, your family, your school using them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Brittany Keller-Hamilton. She's an epidemiologist and assistant professor of medical oncology at The Ohio State University. She's with us today to talk about the popularity of nicotine pouches, how they're marketed, if they're marketed to younger people, and if younger people are using them, what impacts they can have on our health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has anybody spotted these things in the wild? Is this something you've tried maybe as an alternative to smoking a cigarette or smokeless tobacco or vaping? Have you seen younger people in your community? Love to hear if people at schools are seeing these things show up. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brittany, one hope for these, I think, for some people is you know, if I could use these instead of smoking a cigarette, well, that's probably a net gain in health. What do we know about the possibility of these being an alternative that might lead someone to use less dangerous or more dangerous products less often?
Thanks. That's a great question. And that's the type of research that I've really been focused on lately. Can we regulate nicotine pouches so that they're maximally appealing to smokers and people who use other forms of smokeless tobacco, and at the same time, too harsh for young people? And I do think that there is a potential there because, as you had mentioned earlier in the hour, nicotine pouches are available in a range of nicotine concentrations. Some of them do deliver quite a lot of nicotine. And there are other characteristics of pouches that can further speed up that nicotine delivery. So we've done research showing that nicotine pouches deliver nicotine slower than a cigarette, but their peak, the peak levels that people get in their plasma of nicotine, can be within the same range. So it might be a product that is appealing to smokers or smokeless tobacco users who are used to getting a lot of nicotine from their products. If they shop around and they find the right type of pouch that delivers the hit that they're seeking, they might be able to start to cut down on their smoking or smokeless tobacco use. That being said, that long-term research hasn't been conducted to see how effective nicotine pouches are against other forms of smoking cessation therapy, like nicotine lozenges or gums or patches.
Yeah, your research that you mentioned, you've looked at whether, correct me if I'm stating this wrong, whether that pouch kind of fits the bill for that person who's used to smoking a cigarette, getting that instant bit of nicotine, and if that's going to reduce their cravings for the actual, you know, physical cigarette. Given that curve you mentioned of that slower impact of the nicotine, is it doing that job?
So we find that over the course of the 90 minutes that we followed people in this study, for most of that time, their craving for a cigarette was similar, whether we asked them to smoke a cigarette or whether we asked them to use a nicotine pouch. However, at 5 minutes, which is when people reach their peak nicotine level from smoking, the nicotine pouches weren't really even craving as well as a cigarette. So it's kind of a point where if you have a motivated individual who's really trying to quit smoking, they might be able to hang on long enough to avoid smoking that cigarette using a nicotine pouch. But again, that's research that will need to be conducted to see how well nicotine pouches perform in that setting.
We heard from Evan in Superior, who says, as someone who's tried to quit smoking, nicotine pouches seem like a cheaper and more convenient alternative to smoking cessation aids like a Nicorette. Both hold equal amounts of nicotine, i.e. 2 or 4 milligrams, Evan says. How do these vary from the smoking cessation aids that one would purchase in a pharmacy? It's a fantastic question, Brittany. How do you stack up the pouches versus patches or gum?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. So one key way that pouches differ is that the total nicotine available in a pouch is typically higher. So the most popular pouch right now is a Zyn 6 milligram pouch in the United States, and that's higher than you typically see for a gum or a lozenge. And on even goes up to 8 milligrams per pouch. And then there are other chemical properties of pouches related to their pH that will speed up or even slow down, you could say, their nicotine delivery, to kind of help the user manage the strength of the hit that they get. So that's, you know, the nicotine characteristics are a little bit different. There's a little more variety in pouches. The other way that they differ is there are a lot of flavors available, which is controversial because that is also appealing to youth. But if you are a person who's used to smoking cigarettes and you're looking for something that's flavorful and maybe different to use, there are a lot of flavors of nicotine pouches. And compared to nicotine lozenges and gums, there are usually maybe just a handful of flavors.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Clayton is with us in Ellsworth. Clayton, hi.
Hi there. I do use Zyn nicotine pouches, and I can say that it does somewhat help stop the cravings of smoking. But I also did want to say that with the younger generations, I have overheard both online and in person that teenagers prefer the pouches, so that way they can use them in class.
And Clayton, before I let you go, could I ask where are you coming from and using these pouches? Were you smoking cigarettes or vaping, or what was your nicotine intake before the pouches came along?
I started vaping, then I started smoking, and then I moved to those to try and quit.
Gotcha. Good luck to you in quitting, Clayton. Thank you so much for sharing that. First of all, Clayton said he had started with the vaping and moved to smoking tobacco. As an epidemiologist, that's got to be one of your worst case scenarios for these alternative nicotine products, Brittany.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And we've seen a lot of evidence of that pathway playing out with adolescents. So that is one of my bigger concerns with nicotine pouches.
And Clayton brought up the concern that this might be a good stealthy way for kids in school who want some kind of nicotine product to stealthily take these pouches. How big a worry is that?
So that's something that we're waiting to see play out in the research literature. That being said, I'm at The Ohio State University, where there are a lot of undergraduate students. And I have been hearing anecdotal reports of students going between vaping and using pouches, where they use the pouch in situations where they can't get away with vaping. So I think it's something important to follow. And hopefully we have some research coming through soon to see how big of an issue that is.
Thanks again for the call, Clayton. I appreciate it. Wanted to talk about health concerns of nicotine in and of itself. We know with smoking cigarettes, a lot of the health concern comes from all the other stuff, the other chemicals, some properties of the tobacco itself. Straight up nicotine, what do we know about its health impacts?
So, as you said, relative to all the other constituents in a cigarette or a smokeless tobacco product, nicotine is not that harmful. That being said, there are certain groups of people who should try to avoid nicotine. And probably the largest group population-wise would be young people, especially people before their brains have finished developing, so before age 25. And this is because using nicotine as your brain is still developing primes you for a stronger nicotine addiction. It increases risk of addiction to other substances. And then it's also associated with some other changes in impulse control. So that's certainly a population that recognizing that nicotine itself isn't a carcinogen, for example, there are a lot of negative consequences of using nicotine.
In our last minute or so, Brittany, suppose Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called you up or others or a state legislator or something said, what should I know about these products? What should I be thinking about as I look at possible regulations? What would you tell them?
So the line of thinking we're pursuing right now at Ohio State is, again, how we can regulate these so that they're really appealing to smokers and really far too harsh for young people. So I would think about a nicotine standard that actually sets the bar pretty high. So if you don't have a nicotine tolerance already, it makes you vomit. and then also other important characteristics like the pH of the product should be considered so that nicotine delivery can be better titrated within a product standard.
Brittany, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brittany Keller-Hamilton, epidemiologist and assistant professor in the Division of Medical Oncology at The Ohio State University's College of Medicine. She was with us today to talk about the rise in popularity of oral nicotine pouches and some of her own research looking at their impacts on smoking rates and health. Still time for you to share your story if you've spotted these in your community, if you're worried about their use, or find it a good alternative to smoking or vaping. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, sports gambling is big business with online casinos making deals with major league organizations, and sports betting scandals are cropping up. We'll open up the sports books. And a form of avian flu has been found in cows around the country and in some humans. An expert on animal and human diseases joins the show for a look at the latest on the disease and efforts to prevent its spread. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.